Model Test 4
Part 3 Listening Comprehension
Section A Question 11 If you see your friend Julia in the next couple of days, would you mind asking her to give me a call? I was hoping she'd be able to help out with course registration next week.
Sure, Professor Gray, if I see her. She's made herself pretty scarce lately.
What does the woman mean? Question 12. Do you think you could lend me a few dollars until tomorrow? I left my wallet at home and I don't have enough money for lunch.
Why not just let me treat you? I just got paid. Besides, I owe you for helping me with that physics project last month.
What does the woman mean?
Question 13. Do you want to come with me to the opera tonight? I've got extra tickets, and I think it will take your mind off that math problem that you were sweating over for the last 2 hours.
That'll be great, but the opera is in what, Italian, right? I think I have a better chance of understanding a math problem.
What does the man imply?
Question 14. My new camera is supposed to be completely automatic, but look at these pictures.
Next time, try having the light at your back as you shoot. That will make the pictures better.
What does the woman suggest the man do?
Question 15. The Dean just announced that Dr. Jeffrey is going to take over as chairperson of the English department.
I knew it all along. He was the obvious choice.
What does the man mean?
Question 16. Mary, I've got the bowls out for the soup. Do you think it needs any more pepper before I serve it?
It's really quite nice, as we did exactly what the recipe says. Why take a chance of ruining it?
What does the woman imply the man should do?
Question 17. I'd like to enroll in the free seminar you advertised in the newspaper, the one on managing personal finances.
Okay. Now, the ad did say that you have to have a savings account at our bank to be eligible. Do you have one here?
What does the man want to know? Question 18.
The glare was so intense that even my sunglasses didn't help.
Look, if you take Route 27 in the late afternoon, you're driving straight into the sun. I'd consider an alternative. What does the woman suggest the man do? Now you'll hear the two long conversations. Conversation 1.
Hello.
Hello, John. This is Florence Richardson. I'm sorry to phone you at this hour, but I'm experiencing a sticky issue, and I can't think of anyone to get advice from besides you.
What's up?
Well, I moved to my present apartment a couple of months ago, and now I'm thinking to defer my studies and planning to return to my parents' place next month. Today, I gave notice to my landlord, but he said he's unable to give my deposit back, since I have to stay a minimum of 6 months.
Are you giving him a month in advance notice to move?
Yes, that's exactly what I did today. In the tenancy agreement, that's the time frame requested to notify the landlord.
Yes, that's the usual practice. Well, in the tenancy agreement, did it state that there's a minimum of 6 months' stay or the deposit would be forfeited?
Not that I could remember. Besides, I have never heard of such a clause in the contract.
Well, I have never heard of it either. It could be the landlord is trying to intimidate you. Perhaps you should pull your contract out and have a word with him.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. But he said he spent time and money on the advertisement to get a tenant, and it wouldn't be fair on him if I just stayed for 2 months.
Well, that's not the point, Florence. It doesn't matter how much he spent on advertisement. But the fact is, he shouldn't force a tenant to stay if he or she doesn't want to. Besides, if the contract does not state the time frame, then he shouldn't impose it himself.
You are right, John. You've just confirmed my reasoning.
Look, Florence, I'll go with you to see the landlord tomorrow, and if he still insists on not giving your deposit back, we'll go to the small claims court to get your money back.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate that.
Questions 19 to 21 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 19. Why is Florence worried? Question 20. How long should the notice be given to the landlord ahead of time in regular practice? Question 21. What are Florence and John planning to do as a last resort? Conversation 2. You like living in the city, don't you?
Oh, I love it. It's so convenient. I can take the bus to work, or the subway, or the taxi, and there is so much to do.
I know what you mean. I'd like to live in the city, but to live in the suburbs is better for children.
Well, there are a lot of good things about suburban living. But, as a working woman, I think a city has all the conveniences, including the best food and fastest news.
But there are more trees, grass, and fresh air in the suburbs.
Yeah, but living in a city, it's convenient to go everywhere. There are lots of movie houses, theaters, and so on. You can take them to the suburbs on the weekends.
Yeah, children are the right age. There are lots of things for them here.
You're right. They're at the library in Brooklyn, and they come back home for lunch, Then go uptown to the Museum of Natural History. There is so much for young people to see and do.
Not just for young people. What about me? I've never been to the Museum of Natural History.
Neither have I. When I was a child, I used to go to the Museum of Art.
I've been there several times, twice with children.
Well, I have an idea. Next weekend, we go to the Museum of Natural History.
Okay, that's really a very nice idea.
Questions 22 to 25 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 22. What are the two speakers talking about? Question 23. What does the man think of living in the suburbs? Question 24. What is the man's opinion of the city? Question 25. What do we know about the woman according to the conversation? Section B.
Passage 1. I'd like to share with you today my experience with a new approach to building a house. It's called envelop building. Essentially, what it means is that as you are building a house, you try to leave the landscape feature on the land, especially the vegetation in the original condition. So what you are not doing is the usual practice of land scraping, by which I mean literally scraping or cleaning the land of any and all of the original plants. Why is the approach called envelop building? Because instead of clearing everything away, you let your original landscape elements envelop or surround your house. Let the vegetation, physical features such as hills and slopes or interesting rock formations, constituted a significant part of the character of the building site. The design of the house should take these features of the property into account. Actually, integrating your original wild landscape with a house is not that new. The famous American architect Wright was doing it about 65 years ago. So we are in good company. Envelop building is not as easy as it sounds, though. It's not just that you build your house and leave the land alone. By building, you are already damaging the original landscape. But as architects, we should try to work with environment, not against it. A creative architect can find ways to incorporate natural landscape into the overall design. For example, Wright used the massive boulders on the side of one of the most famous houses as part of the house foundation.
Questions 26 to 28 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 26. According to the speaker, what does the term land scraping refer to? Question 27. In envelop building, what is done with the landscape features of a building site? Question 28. Why does the speaker mention the architect Wright? Passage 2. Too often, young people get themselves employed quite by accident, not knowing what lies in the way of opportunity for promotion, happiness, and security. As a result, they are employed doing jobs that afford them little or no satisfaction. Our school graduates face so much competition that they seldom care what they do so long as they can earn a living. Some stay long at a job and learn to like it. Others move from one job to another, looking for something to suit them. The young graduates who leave the university look for jobs that offer a salary up to their expectations. Very few go out into the world knowing exactly what they want and realizing their own abilities. The reason behind all this confusion is that there never has been a proper vocational guidance in our educational institutions. Nearly all grope in the dark, and their chief concern when they look for a job is to ask what the salary is like. They never bother to think whether they are suited for the job, or, even more important, whether the job suits them. Having a job is more than merely providing yourself and your dependents with daily bread and some money for leisure and entertainment. It sets a pattern of life and, in many ways, determines social status in life, selection of friends, leisure and interests. In choosing a career, you should first consider the type of work which will suit your interests. Nothing is more sad than taking on a job in which you have no interest, for it will not only discourage your desire to succeed in life, but also waste your talents and ultimately make you an emotional wreck and a bitter person.
Questions 29 to 31 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 29. Why do many young people have difficulty in choosing a job? Question 30. What is most important in choosing a career? Question 31. Which is the best title for the passage? Passage 3. We know then that in the U.S., it's the job of Congress to propose new laws, which we call bills, and perhaps to modify these bills and then write on them. But even if the bill is passed in Congress, it still doesn't become a law until the president has a chance to review it, too. And if it's not to the president's liking, the bill can be vetoed or killed in either of two ways. One is by a veto message. The president has 10 days to veto the bill by returning it to Congress, along with the message explaining why it's been rejected. This keeps the bill from becoming a law unless overwhelming majorities of both houses of Congress vote to overwrite the president's veto. Sometimes they do that. Often, lawmakers simply revise the vetoed bill and pass it again. This time, in the form the president is less likely to object to and less likely to want to veto. The other way the president can kill a bill is by pocket veto. Here's what happens. If the president doesn't sign the bill within 10 days, and Congress adjourns during that time, then the bill will not become law. Notice that it is only at the end of an entire session of Congress that the pocket veto can be used, not just whenever Congress takes a shorter break, say, for a summer vacation. After a pocket veto, that particular bill is dead. If a lawmaker in Congress wants to push the matter in their next session, they'll have to start all over with a brand new version of the bill.
Questions 32 to 35 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 32. What is the main topic of the talk? Question 33. According to the speaker, what does the veto message explain? Question 34. According to the speaker, what do lawmakers often do after a veto message is issued? Question 35. What happens to a bill as a result of a pocket veto? Section C. Now listen to the passage.
There are two basic ways to see growth, one as a product, the other as a process. People have generally viewed personal growth as an external result or product that can easily be identified and measured. By contrast, the process of personal growth is much more difficult to determine, since by definition it is a journey and not the specific signposts or landmarks along the way. The process is not the road itself, but rather the attitudes and feelings people have, their caution or courage as they encounter new experiences and unexpected obstacles. In this process, the journey never really ends. There are always new ways to experience the world, new ideas to try, new challenges to accept. In order to grow, to travel new roads, people need to have a willingness to take risks, to confront the unknown, and to accept the possibility that they may fail at first. How we see ourselves as we try a new way of being is essential to our ability to grow. Do we perceive ourselves as quick and curious? If so, then we tend to take more chances and to be more open to unfamiliar experiences. Do we think we're shy and indecisive? Then our sense of timidity can cause us to hesitate, to move slowly, and not to take a step until we know the ground is safe. Do we think we're slow to adapt to change, or that we're not smart enough to cope with a new challenge? Then we're likely to take a more passive role or not try at all. These feelings of insecurity and self-doubt are both unavoidable and necessary if we are to change and grow. If we do not confront and overcome these internal fears and doubts, if we protect ourselves too much, then we cease to grow. We become trapped inside a shell of our own making.
Now the passage will be read again. There are two basic ways to see growth, one as a product, the other as a process. People have generally viewed personal growth as an external result or product that can easily be identified and measured. By contrast, the process of personal growth is much more difficult to determine, since by definition, It is a journey and not the specific signposts or landmarks along the way. The process is not the road itself, but rather the attitudes and feelings people have, their caution or courage, as they encounter new experiences and unexpected obstacles. In this process, the journey never really ends. There are always new ways to experience the world, new ideas to try, new challenges to accept. In order to grow, to travel new roads, people need to have a willingness to take risks, to confront the unknown, and to accept the possibility that they may fail at first. How we see ourselves as we try a new way of being is essential to our ability to grow. Do we perceive ourselves as quick and curious? If so, then we tend to take more chances and to be more open to unfamiliar experiences. Do we think we're shy and indecisive? Then our sense of timidity can cause us to hesitate, to move slowly, and not to take a step until we know the ground is safe. Do we think that we're slow to adapt to change, or that we're not smart enough to cope with a new challenge? Then we are likely to take a more passive role, or not try at all. These feelings of insecurity and self-doubt are both unavoidable and necessary if we are to change and grow. If we do not confront and overcome these internal fears and doubts, if we protect ourselves too much, then we cease to grow. We become trapped inside a shell of our own making.
Now the passage will be read for the third time. There are two basic ways to see growth, one as a product, the other as a process. People have generally viewed personal growth as an external result or product that can easily be identified and measured. By contrast, the process of personal growth is much more difficult to determine, since by definition it is a journey and not the specific signposts or landmarks along the way. The process is not the road itself, but rather the attitudes and feelings people have, their caution or courage as they encounter new experiences and unexpected obstacles. In this process, the journey never really ends. There are always new ways to experience the world, new ideas to try, new challenges to accept. In order to grow, to travel new roads, people need to have a willingness to take risks, to confront the unknown, and to accept the possibility that they may fail at first. How we see ourselves as we try a new way of being is essential to our ability to grow. Do we perceive ourselves as quick and curious? If so, then we tend to take more chances and to be more open to unfamiliar experiences. Do we think we're shy and indecisive? Then our sense of timidity can cause us to hesitate, to move slowly, and not to take a step until we know the ground is safe. Do we think we're slow to adapt to change, or that we're not smart enough to cope with a new challenge? Then we're likely to take a more passive role or not try at all. These feelings of insecurity and self-doubt are both unavoidable and necessary if we are to change and grow. If we do not confront and overcome these internal fears and doubts, if we protect ourselves too much, then we cease to grow. We become trapped inside a shell of our own making.
Thank you.